a large group sitting in sort of circular Tavistock manner talked about their reactions to the state of the world, really, not just to the law about Poland and the Holocaust, but about the populist movements that were gaining ground in most places. And psychoanalysts were saying, what can we do? What could psychoanalysts do? And I thought to myself, well, the IPA holds a wealth of expertise. Certainly psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic thinking can make a difference in our troubled world.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Harriet Wolff. Dr. Wolff is currently the president of the International Psychoanalytic Association. And in today's conversation, she shares with us her vision of what it means to be a psychoanalyst in the year 2021. And my understanding of her vision is that it is first and foremost a deeply dedicated clinician, a practicing psychoanalyst in the office, and also on top of that, someone who's dedicated to bringing what we have outside the office. You know, she, off the top of her head, towards the end of the conversation, she said something that was so capturing of who she is and what she hopes for. She says, "We have so much to offer. Why don't we share it with the world?" And that's her vision. And we go over in our conversation, we discuss a number of areas where we are already sharing it with the world. And the shame of it is that many of us don't know about that. I learned things here that I didn't know, and I try to keep up on this. I'm sure many of our listeners will learn the various settings and the many, many senior analysts who are devoted to, in addition to individual clinical work, they're devoted to working on a larger scale. To review briefly her credentials, she's not only the current president of the International, but she's also a past president of the American Psychoanalytic Association. She is a clinical professor of psychiatry and behavioral science at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and she is a training and supervising analyst at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis. Her scholarly interests are varied. They include the clinical applications of psychoanalytic research, organizational processes, female development, and therapeutic action. And she has a long-standing commitment to psychoanalytic public health interventions. I learned from our conversation, I'm sure our listeners will, and it promises to be a very exciting next few years under her guidance. we will be going to new places, but never leaving our old places. And that's, I think, an exciting place to be. Here's my conversation with Dr. Wolf. Harriet, welcome to our podcast. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you.
Harriet, many of us here in the States have known you for a while. We knew you before you became president. You've been active both locally and nationally for many years, and you were the president of the American Psychoanalytic. And that gave us a chance to really get to know you as a person, as an analyst, as an administrator. But you're on the world stage now. You're really operating on something so much larger than you had been, which gives you more complicated issues to work with, different kinds of strains, different kinds of tensions. And I thought our speaking at this point, just at the beginning of your term, would give you an opportunity to reintroduce yourself to the American audience and also introduce yourself to the international community, the IPA community in particular, who will be able to get to know you and how you think as an analyst and as an administrator. And I thought a good place to start is a story you have shared with me about what led you to choose to run for this office, which is no small task, running for office, not to mention serving it. And this was a formative moment that I'm going to invite you to share with the audience, which really introduces something about you, of course, something about the world we're living in, and something about your vision of the field of psychoanalysis and how you see it in relation to this world. So walk us through that experience, if you would.
Well, thank you, Harvey. I'll try to do that. You've cast both a wide net regarding my person, who I am, and as an analyst and administrator. Where to start? The moment that you're referring to was actually one with a previous history of enjoying the opportunity when I was president-elect of APSA and then president of supported travel to international meetings. And particularly, I enjoyed going to the EPF meetings that occurred during those 3 or 4 years.
EPF is European Psychoanalytic Federation.
Right. And I enjoyed the scientific program immensely. I also met the administrative people, the officers from other regions of the IPA, and found the entire experience sort of mind-expanding. It was professionally and personally very rewarding. I went to the EPF meeting in 2018 in Warsaw, and that's the moment I think you're referring
yes.
to.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly before that meeting, Poland had passed a law making it illegal to speak of Poland's having had an involvement in the Holocaust. And this situation, this legal move, had the force of an alarm for me. And the Polish society organized a meeting that promoted open discussion of this legal situation. And there were many formal and informal discussions of what this meant, that such a law could be passed. For me, coming from the United States in 2018, it meant that false facts could become law, and false facts were becoming a political modus operandi in the United States. And I particularly remember large group meetings organized by Schmuel and Mira Ehrlich, in which analysts met. I don't remember exactly, an hour and a half or two, on two successive days. I went to the first one, and a large group sitting in sort of circular Tavistock manner talked about their reactions to the state of the world, really, not just to the law about Poland and the Holocaust, but about the populist movements that were gaining ground in most places. And psychoanalysts were saying, what can we do? What could psychoanalysts do? And I thought to myself, well, the IPA is holds a wealth of expertise. Certainly psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic thinking can make a difference in our troubled world. In the background and at that meeting, I had been thinking about running for office in the IPA, but I think this was the turning point, because I really felt that the IPA was uniquely internationally positioned in order to be aware of, think about, and intervene in appropriate ways regarding man-made and natural disasters in the world. But I think I was particularly concerned about humanitarian crises. Now, since becoming president, I'm increasingly aware of how delicate it is for psychoanalysts to intervene in political matters. And I guess I want to be clear, I'm not thinking of us as politically active, but rather psychoanalytically active. And the forms that takes would be many in my mind. It basically has to do with consulting to citizens who are either being affected by humanitarian crises or aiding those going through crises regarding the psychological impact of their experience. So we have a lot to offer in this perfect storm of international crises we've been exposed to in the last, year and three quarters since March 2020. Add the pandemic to climate crisis, populist governance, violence on the streets. You know, there's so much that has, thanks to the pandemic, increased the sense of helplessness and lack of control on the part of many people, and has highlighted the inequities in society in many places around the world. I think we have a great deal to say about the impact of these crises on individual and group functioning, affective experience, management of their responses, planning for the future. So I'm seeing us as basically taking our particular and deep expertise regarding the human mind and the development of intellect and affective management to the public to help them also manage what they're facing. That could be politicians, it could be healthcare providers, it could be teachers, childcare workers, anyone willing to listen or needing some help in how to even think about what they're going through.
You know, there's a story I was told when I was coming up in the world of analysis about our origins around World War II. And the story I was told is that there were many young clinicians who were working, treating soldiers and veterans in and after the war, who were working with and studying under senior analysts. And many of those junior people ended up pursuing analytic training. And the phrase that I've heard from more than one person is they had the sense that the analysts knew things that the others didn't. And I wonder if what you're describing, this moment in history, the pandemic obviously being a crisis of the order of World War II in many ways, but also the surrounding crises of populism and fake news and censorship, whether this too could be a moment where we analysts, as I hear you envisioning it, can play such a pivotal and depth role. And that's the key point you emphasize, and a depth role.
Yes.
In offering something that will mark us, that will have us hold a place in this moment that others can look at and perhaps want to emulate as well.
Well, I think that's true. I've heard said that psychoanalysis is on the decline, and I actually think it's never been more needed. Outside as well as inside the consulting room. And you say we came into prominence after World War II, and that's certainly true in North America. But, you know, in the 1920s and early 30s in Europe, psychoanalysts were intensely involved in social issues and, you know, starting and active in free clinics, and very interested in bringing psychoanalysis to those who suffered under the stresses of everyday life and inequities. I think now, we bring, thanks to our training, a different sort of listening than most people do. That's at the heart of the depth that we bring to it, and our listening for unconscious themes is different and helps us sort of understand how the person or persons we're encountering are or are not containing intense affects, how they're tolerating or not uncertainty, and how they're basically facing the threats they're feeling to survival, you know, which has very much come to the fore with the pandemic. So, yes, I think we've somehow been perceived in recent, probably decades in North America as silent, whereas in other countries, one that comes to mind is Germany, where research by the Freud Institute under the directorship of Mariana Leutzinger-Bolleber did extensive research on depression, for example. The German government turned to her and the Freud Institute to create a pilot project to address the mental health needs of refugees when there was a tremendous influx of Syrian and other refugees. Mm-hmm. You know, so they set up a pilot project for 800 people in Darmstadt outside of Frankfurt. And I've been impressed that Mariana, who is deeply a psychoanalytic clinician and also able to do research, has brought psychoanalysis to the table in sort of public social policy arena. And I would hope we could do that more broadly and, you know, throughout Europe, North America, and Latin America. And now there's increasing interest in the Asia Pacific. So, you know, I think we have various ways of making what we understand known.
And what you make clear in your vision is that we are operating fundamentally as analysts, as listening and attending to unconscious images and imaginings and tolerating uncertainties, key ego functions that we are attuned to, is what we will bring to this broader arena. And I hear that as your vision. How do you picture it, over the next years, if things would turn out as you hope they turn out, how do you envision the IPA functioning in this way?
Well, I guess my vision for the IPA is that in addition to its focus on scholarship and clinical training, will have an explicit commitment to to social issues. How that is implemented or how that shows itself will be quite varied, I think. There are many levels in which psychoanalysts can be active. They can be active on the ground in times of man-made or natural disasters, like, mm-hmm. for example, a flood in Venezuela. My our vice president, Adriana Prengler, was in Venezuela when there was a very serious flood that put 500,000 people or so out of their homes. And she and her husband, a psychologist, created a two-page document that guided people in how to work with victims of the flood. In other words, what would their needs be? And that having that tool in hand in a moment of crisis allows people on the ground in the context of a lot of distress help others function. So in other words, I'm describing something akin to a toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
Then on another level, there is certainly research of the order that Mariana Leutzinger Bolaber and others have already accomplished and continue to do that shows basically the efficacy of psychoanalysis. We've been, I think, a bit blind to how much has been demonstrated about how people improve with treatment. That's not exactly what you asked, I think.
Includes your broader vision.
Well, it does. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's part of the, I think what you were asking before, it's part of how do we get recognized for what we have to offer? So practical advice, scholarly and research findings, and then also consultation to politicians who want help. You know, many analysts actually consult to organizations, nonprofits, for-profits, particularly to leaders about how to organize their efforts so they'll be effective, how to work with groups so that they will stay as cohesive as possible and be as constructive as possible. One of the people I've worked with, whom I think you've spoken with, is John Alderdice.
Yes.
Who did psychoanalytic training to help himself do a better job with peace negotiations in Northern Ireland, where he was from. And he played a major role in the creation of the Good Friday Agreement that brought the Troubles to an end. By understanding things like your opponent needs to feel he's been heard, the people on different sides of the argument or the controversy need the opportunity to express fully their concerns, their pain, in fact. And if they feel heard, if both sides feel heard, there's enough time and a space preserved for that, there opens a possibility for listening to one another regarding a gray area or a potential compromise or a solution to their longstanding problems. So he organized things in terms of, you know, how people sat, how they listened, how they, you know, structured it in a way that we do also as analysts in our consulting rooms. We have a framework we work in that protects the participants and allows for deep exchange. There's an analyst in the States called Ed Shapiro who has written about his decades of consulting as a psychoanalyst, and I'm fond of his finding. He seems to feel the most important thing he learned in his years of consulting was find out what the other guy, find out how the other person is right. You know, inquire, discover how the opponent is correct. That's a whole different mindset and very psychoanalytic in terms of listening and empathic listening than continuing the fight and insisting that you yourself are right because you know best. So,
You know, it's such a pleasure to hear you name these names. I remember Ed Shapiro wrote a paper with Zinner when I read as a resident in the 70s, and it was about the conjunction of family therapy and individual therapy. And it was a revolutionary discovery. If I recall it right, it was a two-part paper, and it made a real impression on me. And John Alderdice, yes, we had a conversation. My interview with him will actually be out next week. And it was so moving to speak with him and to hear his artistry in facilitating the coming together of these two deadly opponents. And he is also working with you in a group. Tell us about that group, because it represents your vision of the field and how it can make an impact in the world.
Well, I sought him out when I learned about his involvement in the peace process in Ireland. Before I don't know if I was running at the time for election. Perhaps I was beginning to, and we enjoyed talking with one another, and he offered to help me put together a group of people that would function as a think tank that we've named basically after his section of Oxford University, which is we've been calling it the Think Tank on Resolution of Intractable Conflict. And John's connection with other organizations, like something called IDI, that is the International Dialogue Initiative, a group begun by Vamik Volkan and now headed by someone at Austin Riggs named Gerald Fromm. Jerry Fromm is in the group. Sally Weintraub from London, who I hope many of the people listening know of as a scholar of climate change and an advocate for climate change. She's got a recent book on the psychological roots of the climate crisis.
And I recommend my interview with Sally. We had a grand old time. It was wonderful.
There you go.
Yeah.
Svera Varvin, who's done so much work in the Balkans and with refugees, Syria, Afghanistan. These are examples of Chuck Strozier, a professor emeritus from City University in New York, who for 18 years ran a seminar on violence and peacemaking and continues to meet. And so basically it's a group that thinks together. Adriana is part of it. Hank Yan is part of it. There's also, I don't want to leave anybody out, so I think I'll just stop there. But they are analysts, historians, all psychoanalytically informed, working in the world and have been in various ways to try to address humanitarian crises, human suffering, and conflict. And really, it's been a marvelous opportunity. I have learned so much. And I think this kind of a relatively small group exercise, you know, 12 to 14 people meeting monthly to talk about serious topics, really is stimulating. And that's actually the essence of my experience of the IPA. I really feel that the international mindset possible through interregional groups is astonishing. I have also, from a governance point of view, experienced the difficulties, because when we speak different languages and we come from different cultures, we sometimes have difficulty knowing what each other is saying. I mean, simply understanding. You know, the working language of the IPA is English. People joke that the language is actually bad English. And, you know, I don't understand British. British don't always understand American. Never mind, the only other language I speak well is German. And I wish I spoke Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, you know. Yeah. But everybody is working hard, that I'm working with on the board and XCOM and various administrative ways, to understand one another. in order to advance the profession. So it's, you know, it's sometimes, it's hard work, but it's being accomplished by very committed people.
Let me ask you about this committee that you and John and the group.
It's not a committee. It's an informal thing.
Yes, which is important. Yes, I know. It's not in the structure. I understand that. We can all relate to that feeling. and yet, it is such an important thing. It's such a gathering of decades of experience and broad vision. And but for my conversation with him and with you, I would not have known about it. And I dare say the vast majority of the IPA members know nothing about this group of people. And in some ways, it represents the best of our field. I understand it's not a clinical orientation, but we can have a number of bests. There are groups that do best clinical work, and there are groups like that who have a broader vision. How can we bring that more front and center so that when people think about becoming analysts or identify as analysts or have people that we want to emulate, that this group and the thinking behind the creation of this group and the thinking that comes from this group will be part of the identity of being an analyst?
Well, that's a really big and important question. It touches on the fundamental importance for the IPA and in communication and how we make known to our members what all is going on. You know, there's another group I discovered by kind of exploring the IPA website called Geographies in Psychoanalysis that is similar and has been meeting and making podcasts and
what is
having
it?
Conferences.
This is the first I'm hearing of it.
Well, you have to go to the website. You'll find it. It's there about four different times. And it's a group of people interested in part in cultural, the constitutive impact of culture on individual and group development and how different geographies impact development differently. I hope that's a fair enough way to put it. Very interesting group. And I will have to stop there because I can't at the moment remember exactly how they put it. But
this would be, I imagine, a challenge, if not a goal of yours. So not only to grow these, but to make everybody familiar with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, specifically about this think tank opportunity that's been important, certainly to Adriana and me in formulating a vision for our office, our administration. I've been encouraged to think about publishing the notes that I've written after every meeting. So there are different ways we make things known, and I'm hoping to do some of that. So there's writing this and making sure people know it's there, not easy. Then there's also our upcoming Congress in 2023 in Cartagena, where the theme is Mind in the Line of Fire, where our hope is that the scientific aspect of that Congress will advance psychoanalytic theory about societal relations, the impact of culture on development, the impact of societal trauma on individual and group minds. So we have developed our theory about individual psychology more than our theory about group, and particularly group in highly conflictual societal situations. So I'm hopeful that it'll be a theoretical opportunity
And it's not only groups, it's also the individual in relation to society.
That's yes, absolutely. Right, yeah, right, I'm sorry, right. I meant to
say that. We've outlined the hopes, dare say promises, but there are obstacles. There are always obstacles. And it's not always money. You touched on it. It's different cultures, different backgrounds, different visions. How do you see the difficult part of your job. What you've just described are the pleasures. It's like a candy store, all these wonderful things to learn about and to share and to grow. And it sounds fabulous. And it hopefully will be. But there are also countervailing forces. And not that we want to get into all that, but what are the tensions that are important for our members to know about?
Well, I think one of the basic tensions is the problem of change. If having a commitment to societal issues or social issues is new for the IPA, it's likely to threaten the ways in which some members have viewed the IPA or viewed psychoanalysis. I had an interesting moment in a talk I gave, of course, online in the last year, in which I was talking about my interest in resolution of intractable conflict. And a person, a participant, asked if I was intent on redefining psychoanalysis, because I was speaking about educating the public. And I appreciated the question because it highlighted a misunderstanding of what I have in mind. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think a psychoanalyst has much to offer the public or a group seeking consultation, unless he or she virtually has psychoanalysis in their bones. Like, we have to speak from a deeply educated and experienced place. This is not an intellectual exercise where we, you know, talk about defenses and resistances and use psychoanalytic language as if we're making something clear. No, we need to be speaking out of our deep knowledge in plain language, whatever language we're speaking, about, human experience, basically. And I have so many examples. My husband is a child analyst who is, unlike me, I'm not good at this, but he's terrific at working in forensic settings, like testifying in court. I don't appreciate what lawyers can do to another person. And my husband, Gil Kleiman, is unfazed and just simply continues with all he knows and, you know, sort of gives it back to them and then brings to the jury the humanity of a damaged child. For example, an autistic child who's been tied to a chair and suffered from that, and the people who were defending the action say, well, he wouldn't have known anyway. You know, he's impaired. A psychoanalyst can bring to view how wrong that is, that a child, autistic or not, has a traumatic experience when treated in an inhumane fashion. That's the kind of thing that we can. That's what I meant by educate. Bring to light the nature of human experience in a way that can change systems, can make states more responsive to complaints of abuse within residential treatment settings, because somebody has made clear in a forensic setting how damaging the ignoring of complaints has been. So I guess I have many examples in my mind of highly experienced, highly devoted psychoanalysts who have something to offer because they have had training, fine training and experience and a deep understanding of psychoanalytic theory and practice. So I guess I want to be perfectly clear. That comes first. And we have so much to offer. Why don't we share it with the world? I guess that's my sort of simple way of putting it.
You make that very clear. At no point in my having known you over years in various settings Have I ever doubted your commitment to depth of understanding, depth of training, and depth of scholarship? And I see nothing in your wanting to share in the broader world those hard-won skills that we have. I don't hear any effort in dilution. You always make it clear that you are first and foremost a psychoanalyst, and as an analyst, you go out, as the saying goes, off the couch, and you bring what we learn from inside the consulting room to outside the consulting room.
I hope so, Harvey. And as you were saying that, I realized not everybody wants to do what I have in mind. You know, like I'm not going to go into the courtroom. I'm not particularly good at that. But there are other things I can do. And some of our members are just excellent at treating a person in the consulting room.
Sure.
This is just, you know, a broader project for those who could be interested and actually don't yet know consciously how much they have to offer.
I also hear it as a sort of a learning device for people who are thinking about becoming analysts. What does it mean to become an analyst? And there's this stereotype vision of, you know, just behind the couch. And that's fine, but it's not the only option. You could spend half your day behind the couch and half the day working in a hospital or a refugee center or in a community clinic. I mean, there are lots of things one could do in addition to working behind the couch.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to our educational system, let me read your final sentence. You contributed to the book edited by Fred Bush. It's Dear Candidate, Analysts from Around the World wrote letters to prospective candidates. It's a wonderful book. And your closing sentence really captures much of what you're saying. You write, an open and transparent educational system promises to allow greater emphasis on scholarship, research, and collaborative thinking, all good for the future of psychoanalysis. And to that, we could add a social focus as well, all good for the future of psychoanalysis.
Well, thank you for noticing that. Yeah.
Harriet, thank you for sharing this time and sharing what is just the beginning of a very arduous task you set for yourself. I don't have to tell you, you're already in it, but it's quite a job you've undertaken. And
it's also exciting. So
I could easily imagine that. I could easily imagine that. That's a message not only to me, but to our listeners as well.
Right.
Thanks so much for participating in this and for sharing your thoughts. And perhaps over the next few years, we'll check in every so often and continue this vision of yours.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you for doing this for the IPA.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.